Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 6 of NML Crossing, where I think with this episode, we officially have more episodes than my last attempt at an ongoing podcast series. She and Titans, I think that only ran 5 episodes before I tapped out. This one, hey, it's 6 and counting. So we're doing better than that. I tell you, She and Titans was big-time disappointment for me, because when did I do that? I think it was May or June that I did that, and I was so psyched for it. I actually felt inspired again after, you know, I did X-Lapsed for 2.5-ish years, like 400 episodes of that show, and eventually got burned out for a multitude of reasons that we won't go into. But with She and Titans, I started to feel reinvigorated again. And it was, it was such a good feeling to kind of be back in it. And I kind of compare it to X-Lapsed, because with X-Lapsed, I had the current year stuff as well as the Essential series, where I was able to go back to the Silver Age and talk about those issues. And with the Titans, I was going to be able to do something similar, had I decided to or wanted to. And I actually do have several scripts of, the new Teen Titans run from 1980 that I was going to make episodes about. That was going to be the new She and Titans series, or sub-series, I suppose. And I mean, I was super serious about doing this. I even went out and bought the first appearance of Deathstroke in New Teen Titans number 2. That was an issue that, to that point, I had never read, because I only wanted to read it in its original form. You know, I didn't want to read it in collected edition. I didn't want to read it in reprints. I wanted to read it. I wanted to, like, hold it and read it. You know, the Titans are a pretty special property for me. So I went out and I bought that. Everything looked like it was going to be, all systems go. To the point where I was even, like, checking out comic news sites, which I hate to do. I'm not a fan of the comics news sites. I don't feel like they have the reader's best interest in mind when they shill the way they do. But I was checking out whatever Titans news I could, because I was trying to make it like, you know, the Titans version of X-Lapsed, where I'd be talking about solicits and talking about sales charts and all that kind of happy stuff. And in seeing the announcements and solicits, I suddenly became aware that, it was going to become a lot more like X-Lapsed than I could have ever thought. And really just kind of checked out. You know, there's a lot of Titan stuff coming out. The mini-series and the Beast World event, which feels like it has like several dozen chapters to it, though I'm sure it's probably less than 10. It just looks like a lot. I don't know, I just kind of got burnt out before I even started. The entire thing felt kind of snake bit, and I just became very deflated and disenfranchised with the project, which kind of sucks for multiple reasons. You know, I have plenty of scripts that I spent a lot of time on that I could very easily, you know, read into a microphone, but I don't know. I feel like if it's something I'm dispassionate about, I probably shouldn't waste anybody's time with it. So, you know, I won't. But that's not to say that I won't get another wild hair at some point and decide to revisit the Titans. We'll see. But for now, we're not talking about the Titans. We're talking about No Man's Land. Well, the road to No Man's Land, or the road to No Man's Land. We're a few steps behind the actual story proper kicking off. So how about we get on into it here? Today, we are talking about Detective Comics number 720, April 1998 cover date. Story's called Cataclysm, Part 5, The First and the Last, written by Chuck Dixon, with art by Graham Nolan and Klaus Janson. Colors, Gloria Vasquez and Android Images. Letters, John Costanza. Edits, Vincenzo and Peterson, with special thanks to John Stanisi. Cover price, $1.95. Now we open, and it is 7:03 p.m. And we all know what that means. Gotham's in the middle of a 30-second long shakedown. And from our current vantage point, I mean, I couldn't even begin to process the sheer insanity, chaos, and panic. It's insane. It is crazy. The art here is phenomenal. Now we're looking at the Davenport Center, just south of the Gotham Theater District, where 80 stories of skyscraper is in the middle of toppling over. And you know, I mean, even though this story is a quarter century old at this point, and probably removed from continuity several dozen ways, it's something. It's really something to see this happen. I mean, not to be crude, but this truly shows balls, right? From the creative team, from editorial, from marketing. This isn't something like slightly tweaking the colors on a costume or moving a hero from living on one coast to operating on the other. This is a monumental change to one of the cities, if not the city, most identified with DC Comics. I mean, they're making a complete mess here, fully knowing that it would have to eventually and logically be cleaned up. So, you know, big time respect for this. This is, you know, not for the timid. This is a big time change here. Back to it here. We've got the Davenport Center. It's coming crashing down, finally resting against another skyscraper some four blocks away. And so Gotham's cultural center begins to rain with rubble and wreckage. From here, we hop underground, where we meet the person who has been narrating all of our captions up to this point, high school teacher and recovering vigilante Helena Bertinelli. Now, she's on a subway train when the quake hits, and when it does, the entire car is rattled around the tunnels like a Super Bowl. Her train mates begin to panic, and one tries to tune in the news on a portable radio. And of course, you gotta remember, this is 1998, cell phones were pretty scarce, and smartphones weren't even a glimmer yet. Now, the gal with the radio reports that it's an earthquake. Naturally, nobody believes her. After all, that's not something that Gothamites would ever have to worry about. To many, it's more likely that they'd been hit by a nuke, or perhaps the person driving the train was drunk. Now, amid the panic, Helena huntresses up and tries to calm everybody down. Unfortunately for her, she's sharing a space with a criminal who recently pulled a job on Basin Street. Now, this dude, he is completely out to lunch on the quake, and he actually believes the entire shakeup is some sort of elaborate ruse in order to catch him. I mean, he's a nobody, but, you know, delusions of grandeur, I guess. He pulls a gun on the huntress and flicks his Zippo in her face. And that's not a euphemism, folks. The Zippo turns out to be the worst of it. You see, Huntress is wearing a pair of starlight lenses given to her by Robin. And I'm guessing maybe that happened in Robin 3 Cry the Huntress, though I could be wrong. Anyway, those lenses make the tiny flame look like something akin to a searchlight, which is being shined directly into her eyes, and so she finds herself temporarily blinded. Also, pistol-whipped. The baddie gathers his crew and also murders a commuter in cold blood. Like, a literal gunshot to the chest from about 4 to 6 inches away. So pretty brutal. Now, Huntress uses this opening to flee from the back of the train car. Which, doesn't seem like the most heroic thing to do, does it? Anyway, as she runs, the baddie shoots her in her right arm, though you wouldn't know it from the art, which shows Helena with a huge grin on her face for some reason. Maybe she's into that. I don't know. Anyway, Helena manages to escape and hide in order to wait for her vision to come back while the baddies reconnoiter nearby. The main baddie, as mentioned, is quite paranoid and delusional, and he still thinks that this is all some sort of scheme in order to catch him. He has his crew gather around him in order to protect him from potential GCPD sniper fire. I might not have to remind you, but they're still underground. I mean, there ain't no grassy knolls nearby. There ain't no balconies nearby. They're underground. From here, we head up to the surface, where Detective Renee Montoya was attempting to enjoy her first night off in 6 months. Obviously, this ain't gonna be her night. She manages to escape the cab that she's in and yoink the driver out mere moments before a hunk of slab flattens it. She also draws her gun on some looters, and, well, this is where we leave her for now. Back underground, Huntress is still surveilling the Krims. That one gal with the radio, who I guess is one of the bad guys, is trying to make the big boss understand that Gotham was, in fact, rocked by an earthquake. He still ain't buying it, until he yanks the radio out of her hand and gives it a listen himself. Huntress sneaks up behind them, noting the thick presence of escaped gas in the air, worrying that, well, any spark or flame could blow them all sky high. And, I mean, we've already established that the goofball he's pursuing has both an itchy trigger finger and a Zippo lighter. And so, as she approaches, she blows out the flame and tackles the big boss before they can get down to the actual business of beating each other senseless. That first aftershock we saw when Batman was trying to escape the Batcave hits. And this triggers a sizable explosion, which causes the big boss to find himself trapped under a whole lot of rubble. Now, he pleads with Huntress to help him, but she doesn't. He starts, frantically pulling the trigger on his gun, only to find out that, he's out of bullets. Huntress calmly walks away from the begging bad guy. She recalls how Robin had once told her that she's currently on probation with Batman. Which is to say, if she wants to be part of the Bat family, she's gonna have to behave herself. To which, she says, F that. She thinks to herself that she is the kind of hero that Gotham deserves, and, hell, for all she knows at this point, she might be the last one standing after the quake anyway. From here, we rejoin Alfred over in the Batcave. Now, as the aftershock wraps up, he's joined by Harold, who drives over in a, skid-steer bobcat-looking rig. Maybe it's a bob-bat? I don't know. Now, we don't stick with them too long, however, because, we gotta head into the drink with Bruce. And I tell you what, this is a pretty short scene, but it's wonderfully written. And it brings up a lot of the more, it's weird to use a word like subtle when talking about an issue of Batman that has a natural disaster in it and all the stuff we're about to see, but this is pretty subtle. And it has to do with the fallout of the quake. Less about the cosmetic changes to Gotham and stuff that honestly, I haven't really dedicated a lot of my thought to. I knew the stuff we're going to talk about right now were going to be issues that were going to have to be dealt with. But in the face of the actual destruction of a major city, they all kind of fell to the back burner. Anyway, into the scene here, Bruce is swimming aimlessly. He's just trying to find his way out. That recent aftershock that we cliffhanged with. However we say that, whatever I'm trying to say, that aftershock happened during our cliffhanger, and it turns out that that aftershock, well, it closed out his way back to the cave, so he can only move forward. He thinks to himself how he could have had Wayne Manor fortified against quakes, but, well, there's that pesky superhero headquarters underneath it, which during the fortification process would have almost definitely had been discovered, right? His thoughts then go to the rebuilding process and how, well, this isn't going to be something he'll be able to do on the down low. To truly fix the place, he's going to need actual help, professionals with heavy equipment, at which point, well, the secret will surely be out. And so Bruce is trying to make peace with the fact that post-quake, Batman will cease to exist. He swims on, managing to find an air pocket for a brief reprieve from the scuba tank. He thinks about how his main goal right now is saving Alfred's life. Probably Harold's too, though he doesn't get named here, but it's not even about self-preservation at this point. It's not about saving Gotham necessarily, it's about saving Alfred. You know, he's got to get to the surface in order to do that. Back underwater, Bruce finds himself caught up in a current which sends him bouncing into a few unpleasant-looking underwater surfaces, even cracking the lens on his bat goggles. Finally, though, the current slows, and our hero notes that the temperature of the water has gone up a little bit. This tells him that he's no longer floating through the subterranean caves, and he even sees lights above. And well, he excitedly swims to the surface, only to be greeted by what those lights actually are, which is the scene of Gotham City completely engulfed in flame. And that is where we leave it. Next time out, we're talking about Catwoman, number 56. But first, of course, let's talk about this issue, which, damn, what a badass issue. I mean, it was just so good. You know, I don't think Chuck Dixon gets his due respect. And I mean, of course, he is held in high regard, but this storytelling, especially the Bruce stuff, was pretty damn amazing. Now, I think we've all heard or perhaps even had those conversations about our favorite superheroes, where we try and wax on intellectually about which of the alter egos is real and which one might be the mask. And it's usually, I feel like 9 times out of 10, it's Batman who inspires that sort of chatter, right? Like, does Bruce Wayne dress up in a bat suit every night? Or does Batman dress up in a Bruce Wayne suit every day? You know, stuff like that. Which is real? Which is fake? What's the face? What's the facade? And I feel like this issue, that scene at the end, it almost flips the script on that. At least for me. Now, I haven't taken any sort of poll, but I think many of us see Batman as the true self, and the gajillionaire playboy Bruce Wayne as the mask. Like, I mean, Batman is this intrinsically tortured guy, you know, blood and pearls and all that. Bruce Wayne is relatively aloof and jovial. So it's not hard to suggest that the Bat is who he actually is deep down. Here, though, he's like making peace with the fact that he might have to give the bat side away, like he's willing to. Or at least to have it taken from him, you know, if it means he can save Alfred. The secret's gonna come out. His bat half will cease to be. And it's pretty, you know, it's wild, because it's interesting food for thought, for sure, right? But I can almost add like an anecdotal layer to it, where it's been so long since I read those abridged No Man's Land trades, and I haven't the foggiest recollection how they wrote their way out of this scenario playing out. You know, really, really great stuff. I do know, I can remember like the broader strokes from those abridged collections. And I do know that there's a very, very well done unmasking scene. That it plays out. And it's a wonderful, wonderful scene, and I can't wait to get to it, though it's going to be a little while till we get there. But we will, hopefully get there. But I don't remember how the Batcave was repaired. I don't remember how Alfred was, you know, extracted from the ruins. Maybe Harold and his little bobcat skid steer got him out. I really don't remember. But I can't wait to find out. You know, that's It sucks that I didn't read this as it was coming out, you know? I feel like there could have been a lot of really, really fun conversations. And I mean, we can, you know, pretend to have those conversations now, especially those of us who haven't read this or haven't read through it in a quarter century. We can speculate and have those chats. But I don't know. I feel like I really missed out by not being here on the ground floor. How about we hop over to the Huntress, who has always been something of a blind spot for me in the Bat family. I'm sure I've read plenty stories featuring her post-crisis incarnation, but eesh, damned if I can remember much about them. Or her, you know? That said, I really like the focus on her here. Not only did it establish that she was in Gotham for the quake, but it sets her up to be a different kind of hero, or maybe vigilante is a better word, on the No Man's Land chessboard. And I mean, she left that one dude to die. And that's not a very batty or heroic thing to do, though, given the chaotic context and the fact that for a moment there, it was either him or her, I can't be too mad at it, right? I mean, it's not ideal, but nothing's ideal here, you know? Now, I talked about Chuck Dixon a minute ago and getting his due here. Got to give him even more props here, because even if we know very little about Huntress, which I'm very much in that camp, this scene was a great introduction to the character. It gave us, you know, her methods, her motivations, her personality. It was a really good introduction. So anybody who might have been popping onto this for the crossover, you get enough about this character to kind of understand that, you know, she is sort of bat adjacent, but also at odds with the bat family in as far as the way she conducts business. I like it, and I'm definitely looking forward to seeing more of her. And I mean, I don't want to spoil anything that we're going to be getting into down the line, but one of the very few things I do know or remember about Helena is a different alter ego that she will temporarily take on. But we'll get there, and I think that'll be in around episode 48 of this program, which I guess that's uncharacteristically optimistic of me to say, right? Overall, this was a great chapter where it feels like, you know, we're taking a lot of the groundwork from the first slew of issues and moving it forward. There was an actual feeling of true progression in this issue, which, I mean, this is a huge crossover event, which leads to an even bigger one. And I gotta say, I wasn't sure what I expected from a pacing standpoint, especially since so many of the events I've read of late have been of the hyper-bloated, nonsensical current year variety. So this, so far, has been a wonderful breath of fresh air in most regards, you know, pacing among them. Overall, I would say that this is definitely one worth digging out of your long box or checking out digitally or popping over to Hoopla and reading it in the full context of this Cataclysm story. I'm definitely having a good time with this, and I hope you are as well if you choose to follow along or read along. And of course, I would love to hear your thoughts if in fact you do. And speaking of which, we can hop into the mailbag here, where we have a letter from our good friend Walt. He's writing in to talk about episode 2, which was Shadow of the Bat number 73, I think, which was the first part of Cataclysm proper. So Walt says, "I definitely also associate Shadow of the Bat with the early 90s. It was the first Bat title I was able to get from issue 1, and I kept up with for, quote, long-term-ish, several years or so, through the prodigal stuff post-Zero Hour. I loved the trade dress on the thing for the early issues before it merged into the main Bat continuity. I think that happened around Nightfall. I was pretty sure I recalled the final issue of Shadow of the Bat being the end of No Man's Land. At less than 100 issues, definitely one of the shorter long-term ongoings in the Bat family of titles as I'm typing this, I suppose I would say that Shadow of the Bat is probably the counterpart to Superman the Man of Steel. In my mind, they both started in the early 90s, both were significant parts of my 90s DC experience, and both ended during my college years." And you know, I think I would agree with that 100%. Shadow of the Bat feels very much like the Man of Steel ongoing. I mean, they're different in a way where, I mean, Man of Steel immediately tied in with the triangle numbering, but it also kind of felt like, I don't know if it's fair to say, but it felt like the one you could leave off if you wanted to. I mean, I don't know, I think, because I only really, my early 90s Superman experience was Death of Superman. And I remember thinking that the Man of Steel stuff was a little bit, I don't want to say weaker, because that's certainly not true. But I think it's like I said in the first episode of this show, where we had like that weird story about Momo or whatever his name is meeting with Batman. And then we go into the Cataclysm stuff. And I mentioned that in Man of Steel 18, which was the first part of the Doomsday storyline, we had like a weird Underworlder story that had like nothing to do with anything that I'd say like 80% of the people buying that issue wanted from it. So that being my first exposure to Man of Steel kind of, I don't know, set the tone and made it feel a little bit less integral to the bigger stories, I guess. I don't, that's probably unfair to say, but it kind of is what it is, I suppose. But yeah, Shadow of the Bat was very much its own thing when it started. And that's actually one of the things that kind of soured me on the, broader Bat line of books because, like I said, I think it was Shadow of the Bat 3 had that awesome cliffhanger. And then, like, next week, Batman number whatever was in there and he was like in outer space or under the water or something. It was like a totally different story and made me realize that there were really no stakes to the cliffhangers. So, kind of shocked me back to the reality of corporate comics, I suppose. But I think Walter's right that Shadow of the Bat started to cross over with the main Bat books during the Nightfall saga. And I want to say that Legends of the Dark Knight also started tying in at that point, which was also kind of strange, since that was very much a side thing, or kind of like the X-Men vignettes we discussed on the blog. It's like these inserts of stories that happened in the past, kind of giving more flavor to the stories going forward. But with Nightfall and like the subsequent massive crossovers that followed, a lot of those ancillary books were being pulled in. I mean, we're going to be talking about a lot of Legends of the Dark Knight here on this show. Of course, Shadow of the Bat, I think there's like 21 issues of it that we're going to be covering. So these secondary or ancillary or not so much B tier, but not main line Bat books are going to become integral to our experience moving forward. Waltz continues. I've been saying, to myself at least, for weeks now that it would be great to see DC reprint, as facsimile editions, significant runs of older titles. With you sparking No Man's Land back to my radar, if DC really wants me to jump back into some weekly Batman experience, they could do way worse than reprinting the entirety of No Man's Land slash Road to No Man's Land as weekly facsimile editions. That would give them a good year or more of stuff, and put new editions of some fairly key Batman issues out there. While I'd prefer true facsimile editions, I'd also be good with them just doing something like a weekly Batman No Man's Land Classics run or some such. Start it at number one for the first chapter and reprint the entirety that way. For that matter, since they're so obsessed with variants, do No Man's Land Deluxe and get new covers, so long as they'd include the original covers on the issue and original letter pages or such. And, that is an awesome idea. Something that I, when they started doing the facsimile editions, I was kind of two minds on them, as I am with most things, because if I'm not if I'm not worrying or fretting or complaining about something, I'm not living, I guess. But I like them as an idea for sure. I hate the fact that we're getting them with variant covers. It's like a facsimile edition. It's supposed to be the same thing, and we're getting them with variants now, or blank covers. Like, what are we doing? That's ridiculous. But, I mean, I guess people are buying them. I mean, I've bought a few facsimile editions. I wouldn't get the variants, but I did get a handful of those facsimiles, and I think they're a really cool thing to have out there. But, I was thinking a way to do that in a way that they'd be a little bit more consumer-friendly, rather than, like, tarting up, like, a regular-size issue and throwing, like, a $6 price tag on it. Maybe do them in newsprint, I think that would be really cool. It's just like they'd almost be disposable in a way where it's like, hey, you want to read these stories here, you can experience it the way, everybody did back in the day. Though I'll admit I'm probably a little biased towards newsprint because hell, if DC and Marvel decided tomorrow that everything was going on newsprint and they were cutting prices down a little bit, I'd be completely on board with that. But to Walt's point here, while I don't see them doing this for No Man's Land, I could see this becoming a practice down the line here. I think recently DC just released all four parts of Year One in facsimile edition. So definitely not outside the realm of possibility that we will start getting runs. I don't know that we'll get, 100-parters, but I could see them doing, 12 issues of Crisis, maybe Man of Steel, Death of Superman, Nightfall. I could see those getting facsimile editions. even though a lot of those issues are readily available in most 50 cent bins at this point, but not Crisis, but Death of Superman and Nightfall for sure. Walt wraps up talking about the spendiness of the issues and the Harley issue in particular. Now he says, as is, I figure I'll have to dig out some of my existing issues. Some of these, especially the Batman title proper, are a bit more expensive than I'm willing to pay for convenience copies, when I know I have many of them already somewhere in the long boxes. And on the Harley issue, I'm confident that I still have my reprint. It was either second or third print from around that time. Didn't get the first print, I missed that one, and they were on reprints by the time I was able to find a copy. That said, at this point, some 25-ish years later, that reprint has more sentimental value to me because of associating it very much with that time period. It was one of the earliest comics I do recall getting after going off to college. And yeah, you know, I can remember where I was when I saw it on the wall the first time. And it was priced, like, just outside what I was willing to pay for it. And I figured, I mean, who would have known back in 1999 that that Harley Quinn would be, you know, one of DC's most recognizable characters and starring in however many movies. And, I mean, it's just insane to consider, isn't it? Plus, she's got, like, staying power. You know, I was talking to a buddy of mine. I was talking to my buddy Dave about the, like, first appearances of characters who went on to become have movies made about them or featured in a movie or in the background of a scene in a movie, and how that causes the value of their first appearances to just skyrocket, and how with Marvel characters it's like a permanent leveling up. You know, like Rocket Raccoon's first appearance was a dollar bin book, and now it's like, I don't even know how much money it costs, but it's expensive. You know, it's folding money for sure. It's a lot of folding money, I'm guessing. But with DC, it's a little different. You know, we have like these bursts of interest when a movie comes out or is announced or people are getting ready for it. Most recently with the Jaime Reyes Blue Beetle. You know, the Blue Beetle movie came out and all of a sudden Infinite Crisis jumped out of the 50 cent bin and was going up on the wall for like 50, 60, 70 bucks. Now the movie's passed and it's back down to like 15, 20 bucks. You know, it didn't have the staying power. Harley Quinn, however, that's a whole different basket of apples, isn't it? You know, it just keeps going up, the value of her first appearance. It's interesting because I don't know if I shared this story already. I might have. I talk a lot. But I mentioned that one of the books I was trying to track down for this project was the first appearance of Cassandra Cain. I don't know if I mentioned that here. I've been talking to a lot of people about this project, and I'm having a hard time differentiating when I'm just talking to myself about it into a microphone. But be that as it may, Cassandra Cain's first appearance, Batman 567, is one of the books that I needed for this project. And I was talking to a guy at the comic shop about it, and I mentioned that, you know, at that point, I only had like 3 or 4 issues to get to complete the run. And he's like, oh, that's great. And I'm like, yeah, well, one of them is Batman 567. And he's like, oof, okay. Well, that one's going to cost a bit. Which, you know, not the best news, but it was something I was prepared for sure. And he said, hey, it's a good thing you weren't trying to get it back when the Birds of Prey movie came out. I was like, huh. He's like, that book went from being like a $5 regular back issue bin book to couple of $100. He's like, now you'll probably be able to get it for like 50 or 60 or 70. It's like, holy cow, that's another, you know, bit of evidence for DC characters in the movies not maintaining their value. And I tell you what, selfishly, thank goodness for that, because I was able to score the book for quite a bit less than I was expecting to pay. It wasn't cheap, you know, it wasn't a steal, but I think it was a pretty decent deal. But circling back to Walt's statement there, not something I'd recommend someone buying a second copy for convenience. yeah, you know, that's something that I reserve for the 50 cent and buck bins, for sure. Walt closes out his thoughts with looking forward to coming episodes and the general revisit of the overall story. Great hearing your voice again as well, my friend, and I thank you so much. It's always great to hear from my buddy Walt. And I couldn't be happier that he's enjoying this little project. But that'll do it for the mailbag. If anybody out there wants to be part of the mailbag, please feel free to write in or find me wherever it is you can find me. WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com, ChrisIsOnInfiniteEarths.com, the old X-Lapsed Facebook group, 90s X-Men, which I've kind of co-opted for this project and probably subsequent projects as well. But I think this is where we will leave it for today. I'd like to thank you all so much for sharing some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight. Starting over after it breaks. Starting over when the story's got an astounding twist. You better turn that page. When push it comes to shove, we do not fall out of love. We